10 miles. Speed was below 200 knots now, and they tried to lower flaps and slats. But the ones on the right side didn't deploy properly, and the computers, sensing this, didn't deploy them on the left side either. The landing would have to be overly fast. Both pilots frowned, cursed, and got on with it. "Gear," the pilot ordered. The co-pilot flipped the levers and the wheels went down, and locked in place, which was worth a sigh of relief to both drivers. They couldn't tell that both tires on the right side were damaged. They had the field in view now, and both could see the flashing lights of emergency equipment as they crossed the perimeter fencing, and the Airbus settled. Normal approach speed was about 135 knots. They were coming in at 195. The pilot knew he'd need every available foot of space, and touched down within 200 meters of the near edge. The Airbus hit hard and started rolling, but not for long. The damaged right-side tires lasted about 3 seconds before they both lost pressure, and 1 second after that, the metal strut started digging a furrow in the concrete. Both men and computers tried to maintain a straight-line course for the aircraft, but it didn't work. The 310 yawned to the right. The left-side gear snapped with a cannon shot report, and the twin jet bellied out. For a second, it appeared that it might pinwheel onto the grass, but then a wingtip caught, and the plane started turning over. The fuselage broke into 3 uneven sections. There was a gout of flame when the left wing separated. Mercifully, the forward bit of fuselage shot clear, as did the after section. But the middle section stopped almost cold in the middle of the burning jet fuel, and all the efforts of the racing firefighters couldn't change that. It would later be determined that the 127 people killed quickly asphyxiated. Another 104 escaped with varying degrees of injury, including the flight crew. The TV footage would be uplinked within the hour, and a full-blown international incident was now world news. Clark felt a slight chill as his aircraft touched down. Looking out the window, he imagined a certain familiarity, but admitted it was probably imaginary. And besides, all international airports looked pretty much alike in the dark. Forward, the French aviators followed directions, taxiing to the Air Force terminal for security, instructed to follow another business-type jet, which had landed a minute ahead of them. "Well, we're here," Ding said with a yawn. He had 2 watches on, one for local time and one for Washington, and from them he tried to decide what time his body thought it was. Then he looked outside with all the curiosity of a tourist, and suffered the usual disappointment. It might as easily have been Denver from what he could see.
"Excuse me," the brunette attendant said. "They've instructed us to remain in the aircraft while another is serviced first."
"What's a few more minutes?" Secretary Adler thought, as tired as the rest of them. Chavez looked out the window. "There, he must have gotten in ahead of us."
"Kill the cabin lights, will you?" Clark asked. Then he pointed at his partner.
"Why?" Clark cut the sextate off with a gesture. The attendant did as she was told. Ding took his cue and pulled the camera out of his bag.
"What gives?" Adler asked more quietly, as the lights went off.
"There's a G right in front of us," John replied, taking his own look. "Not many of them around, and he's going to a secure terminal. Let's see if we can tell who it is, okay?" Spooks had to be spooks, Adler knew. He didn't object. Diplomats gathered information, too, and knowing who had access to such expensive official transport could tell them something about who really rated in the UIR government. In a few seconds, just as their own wheels were chocked, a parade of cars rolled up to the Gulf Stream 50 meters away from them on the Iranian, UIRian, Air Force ramp.
"Somebody important," Ding said. "How you loaded?"
"ASA 1200, Mr. C," Chavez replied, selecting the telephoto setting. The whole aircraft fit into the frame. He couldn't zoom any closer. He started shooting as the steps came down.
"Oh," Adler said first. "Well, that shouldn't be much of a surprise."
"Daryai, isn't it?" Clark asked.
"That's our friend," Sextate confirmed. Hearing this, Chavez got off 10 rapid frames, showing the man getting off, to be greeted by some colleagues, who embraced him like a long-lost uncle, then guided him into the car. The vehicles pulled off. Chavez fired off one more, then put the camera back in his bag. They waited another 5 minutes before they were allowed to deplane. "Do I want to know what time it is?" Adler asked, heading for the door. "Probably not," Clark decided. "I guess we'll get a few hours of rack time before the meeting." At the bottom of the steps was the French ambassador, with one obvious security guard and 10 more locals. They would travel to the French embassy in 2 cars, with 2 Iranian vehicles leading and 2 more trailing the semi-official procession. Adler went with the ambassador in the first one. Clark and Chavez bundled into the second. They had a driver and another man in the front seat. Both would have to be spooks.
"Welcome to Tehran, my friends," the guy riding shotgun said.
"Merci," Ding replied with a yawn.
"Sorry to get you up so early," Clark added.
This one would probably be the station chief. The people he and Ding had sat with at Paris would have called ahead to let him know that they were probably not State Department security types. The Frenchman confirmed it.
"Not your first time, I am told."
"How long have you been here?" John asked.
2 years.
"The car is safe," he added, meaning that it probably wasn't bugged.
"We have a message for you from Washington," the ambassador told Adler in the leading car. Then he relayed what he knew about the Airbus incident at Taipei. "You will be busy when you return home, I'm afraid."
"Oh, Christ," the secretary observed. "Just what we need. Any reaction yet?"
"Nothing I know of, but that will change within hours. You are scheduled to see the Ayatollah Daryai at 10:30, so you have time for some sleep. Your flight back to Paris will leave just after lunch. We will give you all the assistance you request."
"Thank you, Mr. Ambassador." Adler was too tired to say much else. "Any idea what happened?" Chavez asked in the trail car.
"We have only what your government has told us to pass along. Evidently there was a brief clash over the Strait of Taiwan, and a missile hit an unintended target."
"Casualties?" Clark said next.
"Unknown at this time," the local DGSE station chief said.
"Kinda hard to hit an airliner without killing somebody."
Ding closed his eyes in anticipation of a soft bed at the embassy. The same news was given to Daryai at exactly the same time. He surprised his fellow cleric by taking it without a visible reaction. Mahmoud Haji had long since decided that people who didn't know anything couldn't interfere with much. French hospitality was not disgraced even by its transplantation to a place which could hardly have been more different from the City of Light. Inside the compound, 3 uniformed soldiers collected the Americans' bags, while another man in some sort of livery conducted them to their quarters. The beds were turned down, and there was ice water on the nightstands. Chavez checked his watches again, groaned, and collapsed into the bed. For Clark, sleep came harder. The last time he'd looked at an embassy compound in this city. What was it, he asked himself. What was bothering him so much about this? Admiral Jackson did the brief, complete with videotape.
"This is the upload from Port Royal. We have a similar tape from the Sullivans, no real differences, so we'll just use the one," he told those in the sit room.
He had a wooden pointer and started moving it around the large screen TV display.
"This is a flight of 4 fighters, probably John Gigi Hong Jiaji 7s. We call it the B-7 for the obvious reason. 2 engines and 2 seats, performance and capabilities like an old F-4 Phantom. The flight departs the mainland and comes out a little too far. There's a no-man's land right about here that neither side had violated until today. Here's another flight, probably the same aircraft, and..."
"You're not sure?" Ben Goodley asked.
"We've ID'd the aircraft from their avionics, their radar emissions. A radar can't directly identify an airplane by type," Robbie explained. "You have to deduce types by what they do, or from the electronic signatures of their equipment, okay? Anyway, the lead group is coming east, and crosses the invisible line here.
The pointer moved. Here's a flight of four Taiwanese F-16s with all the bells and whistles. They see the lead PRC group come too far and vector in on them. Then the lead group turns back west. Soon thereafter, right about now, the trailing group lights off their radars. But instead of tracking their own lead group, they're hitting the F-16s.
What are you saying, Rob? The president asked. What this looks like, the lead group was simulating a dawn attack on the mainland, and the trail group was supposed to defend against the simulated attack. On the surface, it looks like a fairly standard training exercise. The trail group, however, lit up the wrong people, and when they shifted radar modes to the attack setting, one of the Taiwanese pilots must have thought he was under attack, and so he pickled off a missile. Then his wingman did the same. Zap. Right here, a B-7 eats a slammer. But this one evades it. Damn lucky for him. And he gets off a missile of his own. Then everybody starts shooting.
This F-16 jinks around one, but walks right into another. See here, the pilot ejects, and we think he survived. But this element launches four missiles, and one of those acquires this airliner. Must have just barely made it all the way. We've checked the range, and it's actually 2 miles over what we thought the missile could do. By the time it caught up and hit, the fighters have all turned back, the PRC guys because they were probably bingo fuel, and the ROC guys because they were Winchester, out of missiles. All in all, it was a fairly sloppy engagement on both sides.
You're saying it was a goof?
This came from Tony Brattano.
It certainly looks that way, except for one thing.
Why carry live missiles on an exercise, Ryan said.
Close, Mr. President. The ROC pilots, sure, they're carrying white ones because they see the whole PRC exercise as a threat.
White ones?
It was Brattano again.
Excuse me, Mr. Secretary. White missiles are war shots. Exercise missiles are usually painted blue. The PRC guys, though, why carry heat seekers?
In situations like this, we usually don't. Because you can't turn them off. Once they go, they're entirely on their own. Fire and forget, we call it. One other thing. All the birds fired at the F-16s were radar homers. This one, the one that went for the airliner, seems to be the only heat seeker that was launched. I don't much like the smell of that.
Deliberate act? Jack asked quietly.
That is a possibility, Mr. President. The whole show looks just like a screw-up. Classic case. A couple fighter jocks get really hyped on something. You have an instant furball, some people get killed, and we'll never be able to prove otherwise. But if you look at this two-plane element, I think they were aiming for the airliner all along. Unless they took it for a ROC fighter, and I don't buy that.
Why?
It was heading the wrong way all the time, Admiral Jackson answered.
Buck fever, Secretary Brattano offered.
Why not engage people heading right for you instead of somebody heading away?
Mr. Secretary, I'm a fighter pilot. I don't buy it. If I'm in an unexpected combat situation, first thing I do is identify the threats to me and shoot 'em right in the lips.
How many deaths? Jack asked bleakly.
Ben Goodley handled that one.
News reports say over 100.
There are survivors, but we don't have any kind of count yet, and we should expect that there were some Americans aboard. A lot of business goes on between Hong Kong and Taiwan.
Options?
Before we do anything, Mr. President, we need to know if any of our people are involved. We only have one carrier anywhere close, the Eisenhower Battle Group, on the way to Australia for Southern Cup. But it's a good bet that this won't exactly help things out between Beijing and Taipei.
We'll need some kind of press release, Arnie told the president.
We need to know if we lost any citizens first, Ryan said. If we did.
Well, what do we do? Demand an explanation?
They'll say it was a mistake, Jackson repeated.
They might even blame the Taiwanese for shooting first and starting it, then disclaim all responsibility.
But you don't buy it, Robbie?
No, Jack.
Excuse me. No, Mr. President, I don't think so. I want to go over the tapes with a few people to back-check me some. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so. Fighter pilots are fighter pilots.
The only reason to shoot the guy who's running away instead of the guy who's closing in is because you want to.
Move the Ike group north, Brentano wondered.
Get me contingency plans to do just that, the president said.
That leaves the Indian Ocean uncovered, sir, Jackson pointed out. Carl Vinson is most of the way home to Norfolk now. John Stennis and Enterprise are still in the yard at Pearl, and we do not have a deployable carrier in the Pacific. We're out of carriers on that whole half of the world, and we'll need a month at best to move another one in from Lantfleet.
Ryan turned to Ed Foley. What are the chances this could blow all the way up?
Taiwan's going to be pretty unhappy about this. We have shots fired and people dead. National Flag Airline clobbered. Countries tend to be protective of those, the DCI observed. It's possible.
Intentions? Goodley asked the DCI.
If Admiral Jackson is correct, I'm not ready to buy into that yet, by the way, Ed Foley added for Robbie's benefit. He got an understanding nod.
Then we have something going on, but what it is, I don't know. Better for everybody if this was an accident. I can't say I like the idea of pulling the carrier out of the Indian Ocean with the developing situation in the Persian Gulf.
What's the worst thing that can happen between the PRC and Taiwan? Brentano asked, annoyed that he had to ask the question at all. He was still too new in his job to be as effective as his president needed.
Mr. Secretary, the People's Republic has nuclear-tipped missiles, enough to turn Formosa into a cinder. But we have reason to believe that the Republic of China has them, too, and...
Roughly 20, Foley interrupted.
And those F-16s can one-way a couple all the way to Beijing if they want. They can't destroy the People's Republic, but 20 thermonuclear weapons will knock their economy back at least 10 years. Maybe 20. The PRC does not want that to happen.
They're not crazy, Admiral.
Keep it conventional, okay?
Very well, sir. The PRC does not have the ability to invade Taiwan. They lack the necessary amphibious assets to move large numbers of troops for a forced entry assault.
So what happens if things blow up anyway?
Most likely scenario is a nasty air and sea battle, but one that leads to no resolution, since neither side can finish off the other. That also means a shooting war astride one of the world's most important trade routes, with all sorts of adverse diplomatic consequences for all the players.
I can't see the purpose in doing this intentionally. Just too destructive to be deliberate policy, I think.
He shrugged. It didn't make sense, but neither did a deliberate attack on a harmless airliner. And he'd just told his audience that had probably been deliberate.
And we have large trade relationships with both, the president noted.
We want to prevent that, don't we?
I'm afraid it's looking like we have to move that carrier, Robbie. Let's get some options put together, and let's try to figure out what the hell the PRC might be up to.
Clark woke up first, feeling quite miserable. But that wasn't allowed under the circumstances. 10 minutes later, he was shaved, dressed, and heading out the door, leaving Chavez in bed. Ding didn't speak the language anyway.
Morning walk?
It was the guy who'd brought them in from the airport.
I could use a stretch, John admitted.
And you are?
Marcel Lefebvre.
Station chief, John asked bluntly.
Actually, I am the commercial attaché, the Frenchman replied, meaning yes. You mind if I come along?
Not at all, Clark replied, surprising his companion as they headed for the door.
Just wanted to take a walk.
Any markets around here?
Yes, I will show you.
10 minutes later, they were in a street of commerce. Two Iranian shadows were 50 feet behind them, and obvious about it, though they did nothing more than to observe. The sounds brought it all back. Clark's Farsi was not all that impressive, especially since it was over 15 years since he'd practiced it. But though his speech might not have been terribly good, his hearing clicked back in, soon catching the chatter and bargaining as the two Westerners passed stalls on both sides of the street.
How are food prices?
Fairly high, Lefebvre answered, especially with all the supplies they shipped to Iraq. A few grumbles about that.
There was something lacking, John saw, after a few minutes of contemplation. Passing half a block of food stalls, they were now in another area. Gold, always a popular trade item in this part of the world. People were buying and selling. But there wasn't the enthusiasm he remembered from before. He looked at the stalls as he passed, trying to figure what it was.
"Something for your wife?" Lefebvre asked.
Clark tried an unconvincing smile.
"Oh, you never know. Anniversary coming up soon."
He stopped to look at a necklace.
"Where are you from?" the dealer asked.
"America," John replied, also in English. The man had picked out his nationality at once, probably from his clothes, and taken the chance to speak in that language.
"We do not see many Americans here."
"Too bad. In my younger days I traveled here quite a lot." It was actually rather a nice necklace, and on checking the price tag and doing the mental calculation, the cost was reasonable as hell. And he did have an anniversary approaching.
"Perhaps some day that will change," the goldsmith said.
"There are many differences between my country and yours," John observed sadly. Yes, he could afford it, and as usual he had plenty of cash with him. One nice thing about American currency was that it was damned near universally accepted.
"Things change," the man said next.
"Things have changed," John agreed. He looked at a slightly more expensive necklace. It wasn't any problem handling them. One thing about Islamic countries, they had a way of discouraging thieves.
"There's so little smiling here, and this is a market street."
"You have two men following you."
"Really?
Well, I'm not breaking any laws, am I?" Clark asked with some obvious concern.
"No, you are not."
But the man was nervous.
"This one," John said, handing it to the goldsmith.
"How will you pay?"
"American dollars, is that okay?"
"Yes, and the price is 900 of your dollars."
It required all of his control not to show surprise. Even in a New York wholesale shop, this necklace would have been triple that. And while he wasn't quite prepared to spend that much, haggling was part of the fun of shopping in this part of the world. He'd figured that he could talk the guy down to maybe 1,500, still a considerable bargain. Had he heard the man properly?
900.
An emphatic finger pointed right at his heart.
800, not a dollar less. You wish to ruin me? He added loudly.
You bargain hard.
Clark adopted a defensive posture for the benefit of the watchers who were coming closer.
You are an unbeliever. You expect charity? This is a fine necklace, and I hope you will give it to your honorable wife and not to a lesser debauched woman.
Clark figured he'd put the man in enough danger. He pulled out his wallet and counted off the bills, handing them over.
You pay me too much. I am not a thief.
The goldsmith handed one back.
$700 for this?
Excuse me, I meant no insult, John said, pocketing the necklace, which the man not quite tossed to him without a case.
We are not all barbarians, the dealer said quietly,
abruptly turning his back a split second later. Clark and Lefebvre walked to the end of the street and headed to the right. They moved quickly, forcing their tail to follow.
What the hell? The CIA officer observed.
He hadn't expected anything like that to happen.
Yes, the enthusiasm for the regime has abated somewhat. What you saw is representative.
That was nicely done, Monsieur Clark. How long in the agency?
Long enough that I don't like being surprised that much. I believe your word is mered.
So is it for your wife?
John nodded.
Yeah, will he get into any trouble?
Unlikely, Lefebvre said. He may have lost money on the exchange, Clark.
An interesting gesture, was it not?
Let's get back. I have a cabinet secretary to wake up.
They were back in 15 minutes. John went right to his room.
What's the weather like outside, Mr. C?
Clark reached into his pocket and tossed something across the room. Chavez caught it.
Heavy.
What do you suppose it costs, Domingo?
Looks like 21 carat. Feels like it, too. Couple of grand, easy.
Would you believe 700?
You related to the guy, John? Chavez asked with a laugh.
The laugh stopped.
I thought they didn't like us here.
Things change, John said quietly, quoting the goldsmith.
How bad was it?
Kathy asked. 104 survivors, it says. Some pretty beat up. 90 confirmed dead. About 30 still unaccounted for, meaning they're dead too, just haven't identified the body parts yet, Jack said, reading the dispatch just brought to the bedroom door by Agent Raymond. 16 Americans in the survivor category. 5 dead. 9 unknown and presumed dead. Christ, there were 40 PRC citizens aboard. He shook his head.
How come, if they don't get along?
Why do they do so much business?
They do, and that's a fact, honey.
They spit and snarl at each other like alley cats, but they need each other, too.
What will we do? His wife asked.
I don't know yet. We're saving the press release for tomorrow morning when we have more information.
How the hell am I supposed to sleep on a night like this? The President of the United States asked.
We have 14 dead Americans halfway around the world from here. I was supposed to protect them, wasn't I? I'm not supposed to let people kill our citizens.
People die every day, Jack, the First Lady pointed out.
Not from air-to-air missiles. Ryan put the dispatch on his night table and switched off the light, wondering when sleep would come, wondering how the meeting would go in Tehran. It started with handshakes. A foreign ministry official met them outside the building. The French ambassador handled introductions, and everyone swiftly moved inside, the better to avoid the coverage of a TV camera, though none appeared to be in evidence on the street. Clark and Chavez played their parts, standing close to their principal, but not too close, looking around nervously, as they were supposed to do. Secretary Adler followed the official, with everyone else in trail. The French ambassador stopped in the anteroom with the others, as Adler and his guide went all the way into the rather modest official office of the UIR's spiritual leader.
"I welcome you in peace," Darii said, rising from his chair to greet his guest.
He spoke through an interpreter. It was a normal ploy for such meetings. It made for greater precision in communications. And also, if something went badly wrong, it could be said that the interpreter had made the mistake, which gave both sides a convenient way out. Allah's blessing on this meeting.
"Thank you for receiving me on such short notice," Adler said, taking his seat.
"You have come far. Your journey was a good one," Darii inquired pleasantly.
The entire ritual would be pleasant, or at least the beginning of it.
It was uneventful, Adler allowed.
He struggled not to yawn or show fatigue. 3 cups of strong European coffee helped, though they made his stomach a little jumpy. Diplomats in serious meetings were supposed to act like surgeons in an operating room, and he had long practice in showing none of his emotions, jumpy stomach or not.
"I regret that we cannot show you more of our city. There is so much history and beauty here."
Both men waited for the words to be translated. The translator was 30-ish, male, intense, and, Adler saw, afraid of Darii, he wondered. He was probably a ministry official, dressed in a suit that needed a little pressing, but the Ayatollah was in robes, emphasizing his national and clerical identity. Mahmud Haji was grave, but not hostile in demeanor, and strangely he seemed totally lacking in curiosity.
"Perhaps the next time I visit—"
A friendly nod.
"Yes."
This was said in English, which reminded Adler that the man understood his visitor's language. Nothing all that unusual in form, Sextate noted.
"It has been a long time since there were direct contacts between your country and mine, certainly at this level."
"This is true, but we welcome such contacts. How may I be of service to you, Secretary Adler?"
"If you do not object, I would like to discuss stability in this region."
"Stability?" Darii asked innocently. "What do you mean?"
"The establishment of the United Islamic Republic has created the largest country in the region. This is a matter of concern to some."
"I would say that we have improved stability. Was not the Iraqi regime the destabilizing influence? Did not Iraq start 2 aggressive wars? We certainly did no such thing."
"That is true," Adler agreed.
"Islam is a religion of peace and brotherhood," Darii went on, speaking as the teacher he'd been for years.
Probably a tough one, Adler thought to himself, with steel under the gentle voice. That is also true. But in the world of men, the rules of religion are not always followed by those who call themselves religious, the American pointed out. Other countries do not accept the rule of God as we do. Only in the recognition of that rule can men hope to find peace and justice. That means more than saying the words. One must also live the words. And thank you for the Sunday school lesson, Adler thought, with a respectful nod. Then why the hell do you support Hezbollah? My country wishes no more than peace in this region. Throughout the world, for that matter. As is indeed the wish of Allah, as revealed to us through the Prophet. He was sticking to the script, Adler saw. Once upon a time, President Jimmy Carter had dispatched an emissary to visit this man's boss, Khomeini, at his exile home in France. The Shah had been in deep political trouble then, and the opposition had been sounded out just to hedge America's bets. The emissary had come home after the meeting to tell his president that Khomeini was a saint. Carter had accepted the report at face value and brought about the removal of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, allowing the saint to supplant him. Oops. The next administration had dealt with the same man and gotten nothing more for it than a scandal and world ridicule. Ouch. Those were mistakes Adler was determined not to repeat. It is also one of my country's principles that international borders are to be honored. Respect for territorial integrity is the sine qua non of regional and global stability.
Secretary Adler, all men are brothers. This is the will of Allah. Brothers make quarrel from time to time, but to make war is hateful to God. In any case, I find the substance of your remarks somewhat unsettling. You seem to suggest that we have unfriendly intentions to our neighbors. Why do you say such a thing?
Excuse me, I think you misunderstand. I make no such suggestions. I have come merely to discuss mutual concerns.
Your country and its associates and allies depend on this region for their economic health. We will not do harm to that. You need our oil. We need the things that oil money can buy. Ours is a trading culture, you know that. Our culture is also Islamic. And it is a source of great pain to me that the West seems never to appreciate the substance of our faith. We are not barbarians, despite what your Jewish friends may say. We have, in fact, no religious quarrel with the Jews. Their patriarch Abraham came from this region. They were the first to proclaim the true God, and truly there should be peace between us.
It pleases me to hear those words. How may we bring this peace about? Adler asked, wondering when the last time had been that someone had tried to drop a whole olive tree on his head.
With time and with talk. Perhaps it is better that we should have direct contacts. They, too, are people of trade, in addition to being people of faith.
Adler wondered what he meant by that. Direct contacts with Israel. Was it an offer, or a sop to toss at the American government?
And your Islamic neighbors? We share the faith. We share oil. We share a culture. We are already one in so many ways.
Outside, Clark, Chavez, and the ambassador sat quietly. The office personnel studiously ignored them, after having provided the usual refreshments. The security people stood about, not looking at the visitors, but not looking away from them either. For Chavez, it was a chance to meet a new people. He noted that the setting was old-fashioned, and oddly shabby, as though the building hadn't changed much since the departure of the previous government. A long time ago, he reminded himself. And it wasn't so much that things were run down as that they weren't modern. There was a real tension here, though, that he could feel in the air. An American office staff would have looked at him with curiosity. The six people in this room did not. Why? Clark had expected that. Being ignored didn't surprise him. He and Ding were here as security troops, and they were just furniture, unworthy of notice. The people here would be trusted aides and underlings, faithful to their boss because they had to be. They had a measure of power because of him. These visitors would either ratify that power in the international sense or threaten it. And while that was important to their individual well-being, they could no more affect it than they could affect the weather. And so they just tuned their visitors out, except for the security pukes, who were trained to view everyone as a threat, even though protocol disallowed them from the physical intimidation which they would have preferred to show. For the ambassador it was one more exercise in diplomacy, conversations in carefully chosen words, selected to show little on the one hand, and to uncover much on the other. He could guess at what was being said by both sides. He could even guess at the real meaning of the words. It was their truth that interested him. What did Daryai have planned? The ambassador and his country hoped for peace in the region, and so he and his colleagues had prepped Adler to feel open to that possibility, while at the same time not knowing how this would really go. An interesting man, Daryai. A man of God who had surely murdered the Iraqi president. A man of peace and justice who ruled his country with an iron hand. A man of mercy who clearly had his own personal staff terrified of him. You had only to look around the room to see that. A modern Middle Eastern Richelieu? There was a novel thought, the Frenchman joked to himself behind an impassive face. He'd have to run that idea past his ministry later today. And in with him, right now, was a brand new American minister. He allowed for the fact that Adler had a fine reputation as a career diplomat, but was he good enough for this task?
"Why do we discuss this? Why should I have territorial ambitions?" Daryai asked, almost pleasantly, but telegraphing his irritation. "My people desire only peace. There has been too much strife here. For all my life I have studied and taught the faith, and now, finally, in the closing days of my life, there is peace. We have no more wish for this region than that, except perhaps to re-establish our friendship with your country."
"On that we should talk further. I thank your country for not hindering the removal of trade sanctions against the former country of Iraq. Perhaps that is a beginning. At the same time, we would prefer that America did not interfere in the internal affairs of our neighbors."
"We are committed to the integrity of Israel," Adler pointed out. "Israel is not, strictly speaking, a neighbor," Daryai replied. "But if Israel can live in peace, then we can also live in peace."
The guy was good, Adler thought. He wasn't revealing very much, just denying everything. He made no policy statements aside from the usual protestations of peaceful intent. Every chief of state did that, though not many invoked the name of God so much. Peace, peace, peace. Except that Adler didn't believe him for an instant on the subject of Israel. If he'd had peaceful intentions, he would have told Jerusalem first, the better to get them on his side for dealing with Washington. Israel had been the unnamed middleman for the Arms for Hostages disaster, and they'd been succored, too.
"I hope that is a foundation upon which we can build."
"If your country treats my country with respect, then we can talk. Then we can discuss an improvement in relations."
"I will tell my president that."
"Your country, too, has endured much sorrow of late. I wish him the strength to heal your nation's wounds."
"Thank you."
Both men stood. Handshakes were exchanged again, and Daryai conducted Adler to the door.
Clark noted the way the office staff jumped to their feet. Daryai conveyed Adler to the outer door, took his hand one more time, and let the man leave with his escorts. 2 minutes later, they were in their official cars and on the way directly to the airport.
"I wonder how that went," John asked, nobody in particular.
Everyone else wondered the same thing, but not another word was spoken. 30 minutes later, aided by their official escort, the cars were back at Mehrabad International,
and pulling up to the Air Force part of the facility, where their French jet was waiting. There had to be a departure ceremony, too. The French ambassador talked with Adler for several minutes, all the while holding his hand in an extended farewell shake. With ample UIRian security, there was nothing for Clark and Chavez to do but look around, as they were supposed to do. In plain view were six fighter aircraft with maintenance people working on them. The mechanics walked in and out of a large hangar that had doubtless been built under the Shah. Ding looked inside, and nobody made a fuss about it. Another airplane was in there, seemingly half disassembled. An engine was sitting on a cart, with another team of people tinkering with it. "Chicken coops, you believe it?" Chavez asked. "What's that?" Clark said, looking the other way. "Check it out, Mr. C." John turned. Stacked against the far wall of the hangar were rows of wire cages, about the size of those used for moving poultry. Hundreds of them. Funny thing for an Air Force base, he thought. On the other side of the airport, the movie star watched the last of his team board a flight to Vienna. He happened to gaze across the expanse of vista to see the private jets on the far side, with some people and cars close to one of them. He wondered briefly what that was about. Probably some government function. So was what he had planned, of course, but one that would never be acknowledged. The Austrian Airlines flight pulled away from the gate on time, and would head off just behind the business jet, or whatever it was. Then he walked to another gate to board his own flight. Chapter 40 Openings. Most Americans woke up to learn what their president already knew. 11 American citizens were dead, with 3 more unaccounted for, in an airliner disaster on the opposite side of the world. A local TV crew had made it to the airport just in time, having learned of the emergency from a helpful source at the terminal. Their video showed little more than a distant fireball erupting into the sky, followed by some closer shots that were so typical that they too might have come from anywhere. 10 fire trucks surrounded the burning wreckage, blasting it with foam and water, both too late to save anyone. Ambulances scurried about. Some people, obvious survivors, wandered in the haze of shock and disorientation. Others, their faces blackened, staggered into the arms of rescue personnel. There were wives without husbands, parents without children, and the sort of chaos that always appeared dramatic, but which passed on nothing in the way of explanation, even as it cried out for action of some kind. The Republic of China's government issued a blistering statement about air piracy, then requested an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. Beijing issued its own statement minutes later, stating that its aircraft, on a peaceful training exercise, had been attacked entirely without provocation, then returned fire in self-defense. Beijing totally disavowed any involvement in the damage to the airliner and blamed the entire episode on their rebellious province. "So what else have we turned up?" Ryan asked Admiral Jackson at 7:30. "We went over both tapes for about 2 hours. I brought in a few fighter pilots I've worked with and a pair of Air Force guys, and we kicked it around some. Number one, the Chi-Coms." "I'm not supposed to call them that, Robbie," the president observed. "Old habit, sorry. The gentlemen of the PRC. Hey, they knew we had ships there. The electronic signature of an Aegis ship is like Mount St. Helens with an attitude, okay? And the capabilities of the ships ain't exactly a secret. They've been in service for almost 20 years. So they knew we were watching, and they knew we'd see everything. Let's keep that one in mind." "Keep going," Jack told his friend. "Number two, we have a spook team on the Chandler, listening in on radio chatter. We have translated the voice transmissions of the Chinese fighter pilots. Quoting now, this is 30 seconds into the engagement. I have him. I have him. Taking the shot. Okay, the time stamp on that is exactly the same as the heat-seeker launch on the airliner. Number three, every driver I talked to said the same as I did.
Why shoot at an airliner on the edge of your missile range when you have fighters in your face?
Jack, this one smells real bad, man. Unfortunately, we can't prove the voice transmission came from the fighter that launched on the Airbus. But it is my opinion, and that of my pals across the river, that this was a deliberate act.
They tried to splash that airliner on purpose, the Pentagon's director of operations concluded. We're lucky anybody got off at all.
Admiral, Arnie Van Dam asked, could you take that into a court of law?
Sir, I'm not a lawyer. I'm an airplane driver. I don't have to prove things for a living, but I'm telling you, it's 100-1 against that we're wrong on this.
I can't say this in front of the cameras, though, Ryan said, checking his watch. He'd have to do makeup in a few minutes.
If they did it on purpose.
No if, Jack, okay?
Damn it, Robbie, I heard you the first time, Ryan snapped.
He paused and took a breath.
I can't accuse a sovereign country of an act of war without absolute proof.
Next, okay, fine, they did do it on purpose, and they did it with the knowledge that we'd know they did.
What's that mean?
Jack's national security team had had a long night. Goodley took the lead.
Hard to say, Mr. President.
Are they making a move on Taiwan? The president asked.
They can't, Jackson said, shaking off his commander-in-chief's tantrum. They do not have the physical ability to invade. There is no sign of unusual activity in their ground forces in this area. Just the stuff they've been doing in the Northwest that has the Russians so annoyed. So from a military point of view, the answer is no.
Airborne invasion? Ed Foley asked.
Robbie shook his head.
They don't have the airlift capacity, and even if they tried, the ROC has enough air defense assets to turn it into early duck season. They could stage an air-sea battle, like I told you last night, but it'll cost them ships and planes.
For what purpose? The J-3 asked.
So did they splash an airliner to test us? POTUS wondered.
That doesn't make sense either.
If you say me instead of us, that's a possibility, the DCI said quietly.
Come on, Director, Goodley objected. There were 200 people on that plane, and they must have thought they'd kill them all.
Let's not be too naive, Ben, Foley observed tolerantly. They don't share our sentimentality for human life over there, do they?
No, but...
Ryan interrupted.
Okay, hold it. We think this was a deliberate act, but we don't have positive proof, and we have no idea what its purpose might have been. And if we don't, I can't call it a deliberate act, right?
There were nods.
Fine. Now in 15 minutes I have to go down to the press room and deliver this statement, and then the reporters will ask me questions, and the only answers I can give them will be lies.
That about sums it up, Mr. President, Van Dam confirmed.
Well, isn't that just great, Jack snarled. And Beijing will know, or at least suspect, that I'm lying.
Possible, but not certain on that, Ed Foley observed.
I'm not good at lying, Ryan told them.
Learn how, the chief of staff advised.
Quickly.
There was no talking on the flight from Tehran to Paris. Adler took a comfortable seat in the back, got out a legal pad, and wrote the whole way, using his trained memory to reconstruct the conversation, then added a series of personal observations on everything from Darii's physical appearance to the clutter on his desk. After that, he examined the notes for an hour, and started making analytical comments. In the process, he wore down half a dozen pencils. The layover in Paris lasted less than an hour, enough for Adler to spend a little time with Claude again, and for his escorts to have a quick drink. Then it was off again in their Air Force VC-20B.
"How'd it go?" John asked.
Adler had to remind himself that Clark was on the SNI team, and not just a gun-toting SPO.
First, what did you find out on your walk?
The senior CIA officer reached in his pocket and handed the Secretary of State a gold necklace.
Does this mean we're engaged? Adler asked, with a surprised chuckle.
Clark gestured to his partner.
No, sir, he's engaged.
Now that they were aloft, the cabin crewman who ran the communications panel turned on his equipment. The fax machine started chirping at once.
We have confirmed 11 American deaths, with 3 more U.S. citizens missing. 4 of the American survivors are injured and are being treated in local hospitals. That concludes my opening statement, the president told them.
Mr. President, 30 voices called at once.
One at a time, please. Jack pointed to a woman in the first row. Beijing claims that Taiwan shot first. Can we confirm that?
We are examining some information, but it takes a while to figure these things out. And until such time as we have definitive information, I do not think it proper to draw any conclusions at this time.
But both sides traded shots, didn't they? She asked as a follow-up.
That would seem to be the case, yes.
So then do we know whose missile hit the Airbus?
As I said, we are still examining the data.
Keep it short, Jack, he told himself.
And that wasn't quite a lie, was it?
Yes.
He pointed to another reporter.
Mr. President, with so many American citizens lost, what action will you be taking to ensure this does not happen again?
At least this one he could answer truthfully.
We are examining options right now. Beyond that, I have nothing to say except that we call on both Chinas to step back and think about their actions. The loss of innocent life is in the interest of no country. Military exercises there have been ongoing for some time now, and the resulting tension is not helpful to regional stability.
So you're asking both countries to suspend their exercises?
We're going to ask them to consider that, yes.
Mr. President, said John Plummer, this is your first foreign policy crisis, and... Ryan looked down at the elderly reporter and wanted to observe that his first domestic crisis had been of his making. But you couldn't afford to make enemies of the press, and you could only make friends with them if they liked you. An altogether unlikely possibility, he'd come to understand.
Mr. Plummer, before you can do anything, you have to find out the facts. We're working on that just as hard as we can. I had my national security team in this morning.
But not Secretary Adler, Plummer pointed out. Good reporter that he was, he'd checked the official cars on West Executive Drive.
Why wasn't he here?
He'll be in later today, Ryan dodged.
Where is he now? Plummer persisted.
Ryan just shook his head. Can we limit this to just one topic? It's a little early in the morning for so many questions, and as you pointed out, I do have a situation to deal with, Mr. Plummer.
And he is your principal foreign policy adviser, sir. Where is he now?
Next question, the president said tersely. He got about what he deserved from Barry of CNN.
Mr. President, a moment ago you said both Chinas. Sir, does this signal a change in our China policy? And if so...
It was just after 8 in the evening in Beijing, and things were good. He could see it on TV. How strange to watch a political figure so singularly lacking in charm and adroitness, especially an American. Zhang Hansan lit a cigarette and congratulated himself. He'd done it again. There had been a danger in staging the exercise, most particularly the recent air sorties. But then the Republic's aviators had so kindly obliged by shooting first, just as he'd hoped they would. And now there was a crisis which he could control precisely, and end it at any time, merely by calling his own forces to their bases. He'd force America to react not so much by action as by inaction, and then someone else would take the lead in provoking its new president. He had no idea what Darii had in mind. An assassination attempt, perhaps? Something else? All he had to do was watch, as he was doing now, and reap the harvest when the opportunity arose, which it surely would. America couldn't stay lucky forever. Not with this young fool in the White House.
Barry, one country calls itself the People's Republic of China, and the other calls itself the Republic of China. I have to call them something, don't I? Ryan asked testily.
Oh, shit, have I done it again?
Yes, Mr. President, but...
But we probably have 14 American citizens dead, and this is not a time to worry about semantics.
There, take that.
What are we going to do? A female voice demanded.
First, we're going to try to find out what took place. Then we can start thinking about reactions.
But why don't we know yet?
because as much as we would like to know everything that takes place in the world every minute, it's simply impossible. Is that why your administration is radically increasing the size of the CIA? As I have said before, we do not discuss intelligence matters ever.
Mr. President, there are published reports that... There are published reports that UFOs land here on a regular basis, Ryan shot back. Do you believe that, too?
The room actually went quiet for a moment. It wasn't every day that you saw a president lose his temper. They loved it. Ladies and gentlemen, I regret the fact that I cannot answer all your questions to your satisfaction. In fact, I am asking some of the same questions myself. But correct answers take time. If I have to wait for the information, so do you, he said, trying to get the news conference back on track.
Mr. President, a man who looks very much like the former chairman of the Soviet KGB has appeared on live television and...
The reporter stopped as he saw Ryan's face glow red under the makeup. He expected another blow-up, but it didn't happen. The president's knuckles went ivory white on the lectern, and he took a breath.
Please go on with your question, Sam.
And that gentleman said that he is who he is.
Now, sir, the cat is well out of the bag, and I think my question is a legitimate one.
I haven't heard a question yet, Sam.
Is he who he says he is?
You don't need me to tell you that.
Mr. President, this event, this operation, has great international significance. At some point, intelligence operations, sensitive though they may well be, have a serious effect on our foreign relations. At that point, the American people want to know what such things are all about.
Sam, I will say this one last time. I will never, not ever, discuss intelligence matters. I am here this morning to inform our citizens of a tragic and so far unexplained incident in which over 100 people, including 14 American citizens, have lost their lives. This government will do its utmost to determine what took place, and then to decide upon a proper course of action.
Very well, Mr. President. Do we have a one-China policy or a two-China policy?
We have made no changes.
Might a change result from this incident?
I will not speculate on something so important as that. And now, with your permission, I have to get back to work.
Thank you, Mr. President, Jack heard on his way out the door. Just around the corner was a well-hidden gun cabinet. POTUS slammed it with his hand hard enough to rattle a few of the Uzis inside.
God damn it, he swore on the 50-yard walk back to his office.
Mr. President?
Ryan spun around. It was Robbie holding his briefcase. It seemed so out of place for an aviator to be toting one of those.
I owe you an apology, Jack said, before Robbie could get another word out. Sorry I blew up.
Admiral Jackson popped his friend on the arm.
Next time we play golf, it's a buck a hole, and if you're going to get mad, do it at me, not them, okay? I've seen your temper before, man. Dial it back. A commander can only get pissed in front of the troops for show. Leadership technique, we call it. Not for real. Yelling at staff is something else.
I'm staff, Robbie said.
Yell at me.
Yeah, I know. Keep me posted and...
Jack?
Yeah, Rob.
You're doing fine. Just keep it cool.
I'm not supposed to let people kill Americans, Robbie.
That's not what I'm here for.
His hands balled into fists again.
Shit happens, Mr. President. If you think you can stop it all, you're just kidding yourself. And I don't have to tell you that. You're not God, Jack, but you are a pretty good guy doing a pretty good job. We'll have more information for you as soon as we can put it together.
When things settle down, how about another golf lesson?
I am yours to command.
The two friends shook hands. It wasn't enough for either of them at this moment, but it had to do. Jackson headed for the door, and Ryan turned back toward his office.
Mrs. Sumter, he called on the way in.
Maybe a smoke would help.
So what gives, Mr. Secretary? Chavez asked.
The three-page fax off the secure satellite link told them everything the president had. He'd let them read it, too.
I don't know, Adler admitted.
Chavez, that thesis paper you told me about.
What about it, sir?
You should have waited to write it. Now you know what it's like up here.
Like playing dodgeball as a kid, except it ain't a rubber ball we're trying to dodge, is it?
The Secretary of State tucked his notes into the briefcase and waved to the Air Force sergeant who was supposed to look after them. He wasn't as cute as the French attendant had been.
Yes, sir?
Did Claude leave us anything?